today. It's great to be back visiting PI. And yeah, as Neil says, I'm going to be talking about extra dimensions and cosmic acceleration. Now, basically in my talk, there's only two ideas. One of them from the beginning of the 20th century, one from the end. First idea, and I wonder if I can lower these lights a little bit in the front. Is there a switch? Oh, that's perfect. So the first idea is the idea that there are Big Brother. It's okay. So the first idea is the possibility that there are extra dimensions of space, which nowadays we tend to think of in terms of something like superstring theory. But the original idea went back to Kaluza and Klein in the early 20th century. And the basic hope there is that some puzzling feature of our universe with four large dimensions seems simple or even natural if we add a few extra dimensions into the mix. The other idea is the notion of cosmic acceleration. So by that I mean the scale factor A, which governs the size of the universe, is accelerating. So the rate of expansion is growing larger over time. And this is something that we saw our first real experimental confirmation of in the late 90s with observations from supernova and CMB. And there's also some evidence that an early period of cosmic acceleration, something like inflation, can explain some of the puzzles about the initial state of the universe. So what I'm going to do today is combine these two ideas, hopefully show that each puts surprising restrictions on the other one, and show how the ideas I'm going to develop could be used to help understand the data we're going to get from upcoming surveys in the near future. So in outline, the first thing I'm going to do is go back to sort of introductory GR and remind everybody about their classical energy conditions. And in particular, I'm going to focus on two of the energy conditions, the null energy condition and the strong energy condition, which I'm going to use throughout the talk. My next step, I'm going to talk about how, for a category of models with extra dimensions, it's possible to reduce the Einstein equations for these models and the energy conditions to a very simple set of differential inequality and another inequality that tells you everything you need to know about how the evolution of the four-dimensional universe affects the matter and energy content you need in a higher dimensional theory. And I'm going to use these to derive E-folding bounds for accelerated expansion that tell you how much you can accelerate and for how long in theories that satisfy certain reasonable requirements. Next, I'm going to talk about some of the implications of these results for inflation. And then what I'm most excited about are implications for dark energy, because this is something we can really investigate today. And I'm going to introduce a new technique that allows you to combine constraints from dark energy measurements along with constraints from Newton's constant variation to basically allow upcoming astrophysical observations to probe certain features of extra dimensions. So first off, the energy conditions. There's a couple energy conditions people talk about. The two I'm going to focus on today are the strong and the null energy conditions. Now, if I assume Einstein gravity, I can write the strong energy condition as this requirement. It basically says if I have my Ricci tensor here, and I contract it with a vector which is either time-like or null, the result is always positive. One way to understand this energy condition is that in the Reichardt-Hurry equation, which describes how bundles of geodesics move through a space-time, if the strong energy condition is satisfied, it says those geodesics always reconverge, even if they start out expanding. So if your space-time obeys the strong energy condition, it basically means gravity is attractive in some sense. The other energy condition is the null. The null energy condition, it looks very similar to the strong, except what I've done is instead of contracting with time-like vectors here, you contract with null vectors. It doesn't seem like much of a difference, but there's actually a huge difference physically in what kinds of things satisfy or violate these different energy conditions. It's a little harder to come up with a physical interpretation of what the null energy condition means. Here, all it says is that observers moving on null rays observe positive energy density. But really, the value of the null energy condition comes in the sorts of solutions that it excludes. It excludes lots of solutions which are doing unphysical things, like violating gravitational thermodynamics or allowing superluminal travel. But I'll talk about that in just a moment. A better way to understand these conditions is to think about what kinds of things satisfy or violate these two conditions. Like, what am I excluding if I impose the strong energy condition? So strong energy condition is satisfied by a number of different things, a number of different very reasonable kinds of energy density. But in the case of the strong energy condition, it's almost more interesting to look at what violates strong energy. One of the things which does are a scalar field theory with a potential that's anywhere positive can violate strong energy condition. So something as simple as a scalar field with mass can violate strong energy. There's clearly really nothing wrong with the scalar field with mass term. It's just that this is a very stringent energy condition. Another thing that violates strong energy is sort of a de Sitter universe, positive cosmological constant. And some extended objects like D-brains also violate it. So it's very restrictive, but it seems like you can violate strong energy and still not have any problems. The null energy condition is a bit of a different story. Here, almost anything, any sort of vanilla physics component you can think of will satisfy this, the null energy condition. Scalar field theories with any potential positive kinetic terms satisfy null energy. D-brains, positive tension, extended objects satisfy null energy. Anything that satisfies any of the other energy conditions satisfies null energy. So it's kind of the catch-all. The things that violate it are a little bit more exotic. Something like a Casimir energy does. But in Minkowski space, you can show that the average null energy condition holds even for something like a Casimir energy. So if you violate it with Casimir, it may only be sort of transiently or locally. Something like a negative tension object, like an orientifold plane, is needed to violate it. Or very special kinds of higher derivative scalar field theories, like ghost condensates, can violate it. I'll have something more to say about these violators.
Sure. Talk about something as averaging in GR, because you know the averaging in GR is not really that well defined. So.
Well, like volume averaging in GR is not. But so the average null energy condition, you're averaging over basically a geodesic. And so there you have the affine parameter, so that becomes well defined. And the average null energy condition basically says, you know, you average over this geodesic and you get sort of a bound where the average NEC violation goes like 1 over the affine parameter. So more affine parameter, less violation. So there's various points of view people can take about the energy conditions. One point of view is that they're just kind of arbitrary restrictions that we make, some kind of notion of energy positivity that maybe doesn't mean anything physically. I think there's something to be said for that, but the point of view I'm going to take in this talk is that the null energy condition is something that we ought to respect. The reason is that it protects us from a lot of really awful things that can happen in GR. A lot of strange solutions that allow you to have traversable wormholes or time machines or causality violations are impossible without matter that violates the weaker null energy conditions. Usually, theories which violate null energy come along with instabilities at the classical and quantum level, or run into some kind of problem with gravitational thermodynamics breaking down. So there's no theorem, there's no result anywhere that says if you violate null energy, you have to have an inconsistency. But you know, it's like walking through a bad neighborhood, where if you know what you're doing, you might be fine, but you should really be careful. So in this talk, I'm going to take the point of view that we shouldn't violate null energy and proceed from there. So okay, so that's all I'm going to say about the energy conditions. Now I'm going to start moving on about what you can find out about higher dimensional space-time just from knowing something about the four-dimensional cosmology. One of the earliest results sort of in this category is due to Gibbons and later Maldacena and Yunes. And they proved a very useful result about de Sitter space in four dimensions. Basically, suppose I have an extra dimensional theory. So I have just my four large dimensions and then a compact extra dimensional space. The claim is that if my four dimensional space is de Sitter space, I have to violate null energy somewhere in my extra dimensional compact space. If all I have at hand are things which satisfy the strong energy condition, I can't obtain de Sitter space in four dimensions. The proof is simple enough that I can put it in a couple lines on the slide, so it's hard to see how to get around it. But if I have the compact part of my metric with my four large spatial dimensions here, I have a warp factor, which is a function of the extra dimensions only, and an arbitrary extra dimensional space with any kind of metric whatsoever. I can write my extra dimensional Ricci tensor in terms of my four dimensional one and some derivative terms involving the warp factor. And next, I can just integrate both sides of this equation. Now, suppose I satisfy strong energy in my higher dimensional theory. Then that implies that R00 in the higher dimensional theory is positive because I satisfy strong energy. And my sign convention is G00 is negative. So if strong energy is satisfied in higher dimensions, this whole thing is negative. Now, on the right-hand side, this is clearly positive. So that's not going to help me. Here, G00 is negative again. Because my four-dimensional universe is De Sitter space, it has a negative component of its Ricci tensor. So this term is positive as well. So that means I have a positive thing or a negative thing which has to equal two positive things on the right-hand side, and I have a contradiction. The upshot is just that if I'm violating strong energy in my lower dimensional theory by having De Sitter space, I have to violate it in the higher dimensional one. That's really all this theorem is saying.
Dimensions are Ricci flat, is that right?
No, this holds for any curvature on the extra dimensional space. So you would expect that there would be another curvature term coming in over here.
Right.
But the whole reason they can prove it for an arbitrary space is that if you actually do this decomposition and write out the components of the Ricci tensor, you find that if alpha and beta are indices along the non-compact directions, you don't see any of the curvature of B.
Okay, I see.
It only comes in when alpha, and, well, if you replace alpha and beta with M and M, you'd start to see the curvature of the internal space.
Okay.
Is the conclusion the same if you introduce gauge fields the way Kluge kind of originally did?
I see. In this metric here.
I don't see any Kluge claim.
Yeah, that I don't know, but I think that the trouble is if you assume everything is static, you need to have a static configuration of gauge fields, which is somehow consistent with the De Sitter ansatz for the four-dimensional space. I think there might be a problem there. I'm just trying to think about it. Yeah, I'm not sure that you can introduce gauge fields in a way that's consistent with the symmetries of four-dimensional space. So this is a pretty useful result. It's pretty easy to prove. But there's a couple things you might think about that can be done to improve it. One of them is obviously that we don't live in De Sitter space. We might be approaching De Sitter space, but right now we don't live in De Sitter space. So what happens to this if we assume something where we have W, let's say the ratio of pressure to energy density in four dimensions, which is different from the De Sitter value of -1? Does that change these conclusions at all? Or are we just saying something special about De Sitter space? Another thing is that in the previous slide, we assumed the metric was completely static. But in principle, the extra dimensions could be evolving. There's no reason our three large dimensions are dynamical. Maybe the extra ones could be as well. Finally, the strong energy condition is easy to violate. Now, is it really a significant restriction to say that I violated strong energy in my higher dimensional theory? It might take something as simple as a scalar field with mass term. So it turns out all of these, you can improve in all these areas. And there's some new results on this front, which I can now describe. Basically, each of these new results is of a similar form where you pair something you know about an extra dimensional metric with an energy condition. So for example, I can tell you an example of two of these where I've assumed my extra dimensional metric is Ricci flat, something like Calais-Biot, and I'm pairing that with the null energy condition. And the new kinds of things you can show are something like this. So if I assume I have a higher dimensional spacetime, which is warped in Ricci flat, but is otherwise completely arbitrary, any kind of warp factor I like, any kind of dynamics of the extra dimensional space, and I have filled it with matter that satisfies the null energy condition, then the four-dimensional W, four-dimensional equation of state, is different from one, time varying, or both at the same time. But it can't be just De Sitter. Something else has to be happening. And moreover, I can't have W, the equation of state, remain close to -1 for very long. The closer I try to approach to De Sitter, the less time I'm able to spend there. Another interesting consequence is that if the four-dimensional universe is accelerating at all, then Newton's constant has to vary under these same assumptions. So the nice thing about the theorems I'm going to describe is they actually give you quantitative bounds for how different I can be from -1, how long I can stay there, and by how much does Newton's constant have to vary. And that's something that you can then plug into experiment and try to see if we necessarily have to violate these conditions in order to come up with a sensible model. You can't establish them?
Stabilize
them.
Yeah.
So you can't stabilize them unless you do something that violates one of these assumptions, like unless you introduce physics which violates null energy, for example.
Mm-hmm. So that's basically maybe how you get to these, because extra dimensions are dynamical. That's why you cannot have Abia minus one.
Well, it turns out, so I'll talk about this a little bit more later, but the preview is that if I force them to be stable, it's harder to satisfy null energy. So really, by allowing them to be dynamical, I'm getting more of them out. But it's not enough of the network, so it has to be violated. But I'll talk, actually, next slide about that. So this is a pretty strong statement, actually. And it may seem a bit strange, especially because previously we saw if I violated strong energy in 4D, I have to violate it entirely. Here, if I have even De Sitter space, that doesn't violate null energy, so why do I have to violate it in my extra-dimensional theory? So I can show you how this works in a really simple example, which is not realistic, but it's enough to illustrate what's going on. Let's say I just have a space-time, and I'm going to assume my four-dimensional space-time is evolving with a constant equation of state, so constant ratio between pressure and energy. I'm also going to assume I have a few extra dimensions, like maybe a torus, which is Ricci flat, and just for simplicity, it's going to evolve by the breathing mode getting larger or smaller. So if this is my theory, in my four-dimensional theory, I have a scalar field describing the evolution of these extra dimensions, and then whatever interactions I have are producing a potential for that scalar field. Now, in four dimensions, if I work in conformal time, I know how my scale factor has to evolve. It just evolves as some power of the conformal time determined by W, the equation of state I've assumed in four dimensions. Using the Friedman equations in 4D, I can relate the evolution of the scale factor, which I know up here, to the time dependence of my scalar field. If the scalar field's rolling, it has to have a potential, but the potential doesn't come in rho plus V. So I'm not dropping the potential out of here, it just gets canceled out. So from this equation, I know how A is evolving, I can figure out how psi is evolving, and I get the time evolution of psi here. There's two branches because this equation has two solutions separated by a sign. If psi has this time evolution, I know it has to have this potential. Nothing strange about this potential, it's just an exponential potential. We know that they support solutions with constant W. But now I'm in a situation where I know what my four-dimensional metric is doing. Psi represents the size of my extra-dimensional metric, so I know what my extra-dimensional metric is doing. And in this simple example, I can basically reconstruct exactly how my full 4 plus k-dimensional space-time is evolving. Now, the interesting thing comes if I plug this into the Einstein equations. And remember that the null energy condition said that this term here has to be positive. So you can actually take that metric, put it in the Einstein equations, and see if you violated null energy or not. Now, a strange thing happens. One branch of solution, so for one side of psi, you violate the null energy condition in your higher dimensional theory for any value of W. That's pretty shocking, because for these values of W, null energy is never violated in 4D. It's only violated in higher dimensional theory. So that was just one branch. Maybe I chose the wrong branch. If I choose the other branch, I find I can satisfy null energy, but only to a point. As W gets smaller and smaller, I eventually pass a threshold W where null energy is violated in my higher dimensional theory as well. That threshold W, in this simple example, depends on the number of extra dimensions I have, but it's always pretty far from minus one. The closest it gets is minus 7/9 for one extra dimension. So in this case, in the simple example, you can see explicitly that you had to violate NEC. But it's very curious, because all I have in my four-dimensional theory is a scalar field with this potential. There's nothing exotic about this potential. It's a perfectly natural kind of potential. But somehow, as I tune W closer and closer to minus 1, this potential continues to look OK, but something very drastic had to happen in my higher dimensional theory. Something that's invisible if I just knew about 4D. So to really kind of claim any kind of result, you have to go beyond this very simple example. And you want to look at something where I've allowed more general features to come in. Here I just have my extra dimensions getting bigger or smaller, but in reality they can distort in many different ways, anisotropically and homogeneously. They can be warped. They can have different kinds of curvature. Here I sort of had a quintessence-like theory. Maybe it's not quintessence driving acceleration in four dimensions. There's all sorts of possibilities. But it turns out you can include all these new features, and it doesn't substantially change the conclusions that you reach from that simple example. So let me try to... Sure.
Silly question here.
Yeah.
All the problem with NDC that you mentioned before, they were you have to define the non-energy condition. It has to be not violated in every single dimension. No.
So it's in practice, that's how it ends up being implemented. But really, all it says is for any null vector at all that I can choose, it says.
Okay, you know, so you choose it to any direction.
Exactly, yeah. And as long as I can find one where that contraction is negative, then null energy is violated somewhere.
And in the simple example, it's only violated in the extra dimensions. But in other examples, it can be violated in either direction. All right, so let me explain. Sorry, was there another?
Let me explain
what assumptions I'm going to make. One of them is that I start out with a higher dimensional model where the gravitational action is of the canonical Einstein-Hilbert form. If I have a higher dimensional action that's in f of r form or has a Brown-Sticky coupling, something like this, I can always cast it into this form by redefining my metric variables. When I talk about the four-dimensional space-time, I'm going to be talking about the Einstein frame scale factor. So after Kaluza-Klein reduction, I'm going to be working in a frame where I get the canonical Einstein-Hilbert action as well. As far as the extra-dimensional space goes, I'm going to assume my extra-dimensional manifold is closed, so it doesn't have a boundary, and compact, so it's finite. Or it's a quotient of such. So I'm going to allow boundaries, but only boundaries that result from something like orbital folding or oriented folding. Other than that, I'm allowing arbitrary other matter fields in the action, so I'm making very weak assumptions about the matter sector. There's a couple different categories of metrics that you can look at.
M is the extra dimensional value. Yeah, that's the extra dimensional space. There's a few different categories of metrics that we've looked at so far. There's nothing special about these. They're just the first few examples that we decided to look at. First example, what I call curve, it's just some kind of metric where you don't really know anything special about the curvature on the extra dimensions. One example of such a metric is something like a sphere that would fall into this category. Historically, these are interesting from maybe the older days of Kaluza-Klein theory because metrics which have a set of non-abelian continuous isometries like the ones you'd need to get gauge symmetry in 4D are all curved. Other interesting examples recently are sort of these rugby ball supersymmetric large extra dimensions models are also have curved extra dimensional spaces. Second category are Ricci flat extra dimensional spaces. So there's lots of interesting manifolds in here. Many of the special holonomy manifolds are in this category. In particular, the Calais-Biot manifolds with special unitary holonomy and manifolds with Gidoux holonomy are all in this Ricci flat category. Anything with a one-dimensional extra dimension is in here. So the original Kaluza-Klein is. The Randall-Sundrum model with two brains, which has a finite extra dimension, is in this category. Third one we call conformally Ricci flat. And this is basically similar to this, except normally this factor here would just be a Ricci flat factor. But in CRF, it's related by this little conformal factor here. these metrics are interesting because they show up often in various string constructions. For example, a Klebanov stress their warp throat is of this form. This is a non-compact metric, but imagine it's closed off at the top by some compact space. Also, some of the ansatz used in flux compactifications, like the GKP flux solutions, all use this type of metric. So now that I've introduced these three families, what can you actually show? Well, there's two kind of improvements you can make. One is that in many cases, you can weaken the energy condition. So the sort of Gibbons and Maldacena and Nunez theorems tell you that if you have exact de Sitter expansion, you violate the strong energy condition. For a few of these metric categories and exact de Sitter expansion, you can weaken that to the null energy condition. So for something where before you thought you just had to violate the strong, now you have to violate the null as well. The other big improvement is that if you have a universe which isn't exactly de Sitter, the theorems tell you that you can only be accelerating for transient, you can only have transient acceleration, and they bound for how long you can accelerate. And so, for example, here where we knew we had to violate the strong energy condition, we can't really escape from it if we have W different from minus one. We can escape for a little while, but eventually we have to violate the strong energy condition. And for some of these metrics, which are maybe the most interesting ones to be looking at, both of these improvements are possible simultaneously. So you find you have to violate a weaker energy condition, and for a realistic universe,
you can only violate it. You can only accelerate for so long before you have to violate it. So how do we actually prove this? Well, there's a few tools you need. First tool is has to do with the fact that usually when you're doing Kluze Klein reduction, you have some kind of metric moduli space decomposition of your extra dimensional space. You have a set of scalars which describe exactly how you're letting these extra dimensions deform. You don't really have that in general, but it turns out all you really need are how rapidly various components of the extra dimensional metric are changing. And we just really care about the trace component of that. There's also a traceless component, which doesn't turn out to be important. The next tool is really handy. It's a way of averaging over the extra dimensional space, which gives us a dial to turn, which is turns out to be really helpful in proving these results. Basically, if I have some quantity Q that's defined on my extra dimensional space, I can average it over by taking Q, integrating it along with a weight function, which involves my warp factor, and then dividing by the volume of my extra dimensions measured with the same weight function. And I can dial A to be whatever I want. It's completely arbitrary. If A is large and positive, then I'm weighting places where the warp factor is large. If A is negative, I'm weighting places where the warp factor is very small. So depending on where I want to look, I can just dial A as I like. A third tool is really helpful for finding when I've violated NEC somewhere. So as an example, if I have a perfect fluid in four dimensions, I just have an energy density and a pressure, it's really easy to figure out if I violated null energy. I just say, OK, add energy density to pressure. If the result is negative, null energy is violated. It's harder for more general kinds of stress energies to do that. In particular, if I have a Kluze Klein spacetime, then my most general stress energy tensor has lots of extra components. It has something completely arbitrary along the extra dimensional space. It's got currents that could potentially be flowing. And but it turns out that I can actually apply a very similar test to this more general metric. It turns out that here I have the same energy density as I would have for a perfect fluid. Because I have rotational symmetry in three dimensions, I also have an isotropic pressure. And from the stress energy along the extra dimensions, I can extract an isotropic pressure, which I call pk. The interesting thing is that if this were just a perfect fluid and nothing else, then I could say that if either of these were negative, then the NEC was violated. And in fact, you can show that even with all these additional bits in there, this still holds true. So even though I have a very complicated metric with a very complicated stress energy tensor, if I just pretended that this was a perfect fluid, added up the isotropic components, that's all I need to show that NEC is violated. There's examples where these are both positive and NEC is still violated, but no way to let both of these be negative and avoid violating NEC. So it gives a nice test to determine when NEC is violated in situations where you have a very complicated metric. So using these tools, you can write down the Einstein equations in your full higher dimensional theory. I've written down, you can take the Einstein equations in, let's say, 10 dimensions, decompose them using the metric decomposition I showed earlier. I can then form those isotropic pressures and energy densities and average them using this A averaging process that I described. And you get two basic equations which encapsulate everything. The important thing about them is that both of these have to be positive if I'm satisfying the null energy condition. If one of them were negative, let's say this one, it would mean that this average were negative. But the average can only be negative if what's inside it is negative somewhere. I don't know where, but somewhere. And if what's inside it is negative somewhere, then rho plus p3 is negative, and that means NEC is violated. So if either of these things are negative, I've violated the null energy condition. Now, rho t and pt are the total energy density and pressure in my four-dimensional theory. So including, you know, metric moduli, any interactions I have, any additional matter. In this first equation, if rho plus p in the four-dimensional theory is positive, so if in four dimensions I satisfy null energy, I'm fine. The only problem might come in with these terms, which are negative, which are related to how rapidly my metric is evolving. So it just says, if I satisfy null energy in 4D, it's no problem to satisfy it in higher dimensions, as long as my metric isn't evolving too rapidly. The second equation is a little bit more complicated. Here, if, let's say, I'm close to De Sitter, where pressure is negative, the energy density, this first term right off the bat is negative. So already I have to do something if I want to satisfy null energy in my higher dimensional theory. Some of these other terms always hinder that. Other terms can help you or hinder you depending on what you choose for A. But the important one turns out to be this one here, which tells me that if xi, which is describing how rapidly the trace of my extra dimensional metric is evolving, if I can make this term really positive, maybe I can cancel out bad contributions coming from here. But I know I'm going to run into trouble eventually, because if I have psi evolving very rapidly, eventually these terms are going to get large, and perhaps I might run into trouble from this constraint. Turns out the most useful way to look at the system of equations is to ask the following question. Suppose I stack the deck completely in my favor, and all I want to know is, given these equations, how many E foldings can I extract if I'm allowed to tune everything to be exactly as I like? Am I always able to find some way to satisfy NEC and get many E foldings, or is there always an obstruction? So the way to answer that is to look for kind of optimal solutions in which I basically eliminate all the terms which might hurt me from all the terms that might prevent me from satisfying the null energy condition. When you do that, it turns out all that's important is to focus on the single variable here, xi naught. If I do quick change of variables from xi naught to zeta, so now zeta is telling me basically the fractional increase in the volume per Hubble time. Those equations on the previous slide just reduce down to these two simple ones. They're just describing how zeta, the rate of increase of the extra dimensional volume, is responding to the change in the four-dimensional scale factor. All those other, these equations describe solutions which have the largest number of E-foldings of accelerated expansion that are possible given the constraints from the null energy condition. And so because of that, I can forget about all these other variables that I had. All they would do, if I turned on sigma, for example, all it would do would be prevent me from satisfying null energy. So by studying these two very simple equations, I can learn a lot about what my extra dimensional spacetime has to be doing to satisfy null energy. So the first question to ask is there...
If these are satisfied, that means that you are satisfying all the energy conditions, or is that if the energy conditions are satisfied, then these are satisfied?
If all the energy conditions are satisfied, then these have to be satisfied. This is the right way to think about it. So the first question to ask is, have I actually learned anything useful by doing all this? Are there any bounds? And I can answer that by saying, okay, these are describing the solutions that have the maximum number of E-foldings. Is that maximum finite or infinite? You find that by choosing boundary conditions using the second equation and then saturating this differential inequality up here. What you find is very interesting. If I choose, let's say, universes with constant equation of state W, the number of E-foldings I'm allowed, as determined by that previous pair of equations, is indeed finite as W gets close to minus one. For various numbers of extra dimensions, that bound depends on W. So if W is far from minus one, I get many E-foldings. As W gets closer and closer to minus one, the number of E-foldings I'm allowed goes down to zero. Now, no, it's not very many E-foldings at all. It's important to notice on this axis here this is two E-foldings. So something like 60, which you might need for inflation, where you have many E-foldings very close to minus one, is going to strongly conflict with these bounds. K is the number of extra dimensions. Another way of looking at these is, let's focus on this top plot here, because I'm just talking about Ricci's plot for now, is for each choice of number of extra dimensions, I can ask sort of below what W must my acceleration be transient, and below what W do I get less than one E-folding of acceleration. So if we look at, let's say, one extra dimension over here, if I want a constant W of minus 0.6, there's no problem with that. I can accelerate with W of minus 0.6 forever. But as soon as it dips below about minus 7/9 here, I only have finite time left. I have only transient acceleration with that W. And when I dip below, let's say, minus 0.86, I have less than one E-folding of acceleration below that W. And I should note that this is not just W of the dark energy. This is the W of everything. So in our universe right now, we're about here at minus 0.7. And so far, it doesn't seem to be any great conflict because we've only had about one E-folding of accelerated expansion.
but I'm going to have some more interesting things to say about that later. For something like inflation, where I have to have many, many e-folds and be close to, very close to minus one, there's obviously a big conflict. So one of the assumptions of the theorems has to be violated in these models. So now that I've described what you can show, let me talk a little bit about things that may or may not be loopholes that allow you to escape these conclusions. One is curvature. I've made an assumption about something that I know about the extra-dimensional metric, that it's reaching flat or conformally reaching flat or something like that. Maybe there's curvature that comes in that isn't really of the type that I've assumed. Well, the thing about curvature is it really depends. Whatever additional curvature I have, whatever sign it takes can make a big difference. With one sign, it can make it easier to satisfy the null energy condition. With another sign, it can make it harder to satisfy the null energy condition. And so it's been really hard to find explicit examples where, let's say, someone has a model which produces an accelerating universe, but has also calculated corrections to the curvature in the higher dimensional model. Another possibility is that I can't impose the Einstein equations on my extra dimensional space because of some kind of quantum effect. Maybe the extra dimensions are really small and they don't obey classical equations of motion. That's a little bit harder to treat because I think in those cases, I'm not sure people really know what to do at all. So if I can't, if I don't have any equations of motion, I can't really say anything. A third kind of loophole is that maybe general relativity is valid up to higher derivative corrections. And I've only assumed the sort of two derivative GR action. Maybe there's more stuff going on. One thing, I can't say anything directly about this because I've just assumed regular general relativity. But one thing I can say is, suppose I take those correction terms and write them as an effective stress energy on the right-hand side of Einstein's equations. Then I know, based on these theorems, that this effective term has to act like something that violates null energy. Now, if one of the reasons that I think null energy is important is because it prohibits sort of pathological solutions with causality violations and superluminal travel, then if I've introduced something which violates null energy, how do I know that I don't reintroduce those pathologies? A final sort of loophole is something like a negative tension object or something like a safe null energy violating mechanism. This is not really a loophole because, I mean, this violates null energy and we're saying you have to violate null energy. So this is really a consequence of the theorem. This is something saying maybe it's not so bad. In this case, there's a couple interesting things that we can say. One is that sometimes there can be hidden sort of instabilities in something that otherwise looks healthy. Sorry.
Stringy ones of Gecko, which one do they violate?
Gecko
and their construction.
So I would say in that case they're down here.
They're mining.
So they've got oriented fold planes in those models. Now it's an interesting question whether that will be enough in a couple slides. But yeah.
The extra dimension is not important, right? So why is it important
that
it's compact?
That's a good question. It comes down to basically the reason, like, you can't have an infinite one, is that what you're saying? Because when you're improving these things, there's always an integration by parts that you have to do. Even in the Malassani Nunez one and the Gibbons one, there's an integration by parts that comes in. And you could have boundary terms. If you have something going on at infinity that doesn't let me do that integration by parts, as long as I know I don't have a boundary, I'm fine. Now, something to say is that the examples I've seen where there are infinite volume extra dimensions and yet avoid the conclusions of the theorem usually have something funny going on at infinity, like the warp factor is blowing up. Mm-hmm. And then usually have an associated problem, which in that example would be that the volume of the extra dimensions is infinite. And so the 40 newtons constant goes to zero. So there's often something else coming along there, but it's simpler for me just to avoid doing that by just ensuring that there's no boundary. Right, so let's look at some things that could safely violate NEC, and there might be some interesting questions there.
One of them, so here's two examples of things which are perturbatively stable but violate NEC, but there may be non-perturbative issues. One example is something like a negative tension boundary, which you typically make stable by just saying that you impose a reflection symmetry. And that means that little fluctuations in this negative tension object, which would normally grow, are fixed because they violate this Z2 reflection symmetry. Now, in the 80s, Witten wrote down a very interesting solution describing the decay of a five-dimensional Poincaré-Klein vacuum, which comes from a double analytic continuation of a five-dimensional Schwarzschild black hole. What it looks like is an instanton where you have flat space and then a bubble of nothing appears. There's not any matter or energy density or even any space-time inside the bubble. It's just the boundary of space-time that's nucleated and then grows exponentially and consumes space-time. Now, an analog of that is something you can do with, let's say, if you allow negative tension boundaries in your theory without a charge or anything like that, you can write down a similar sort of instanton, which doesn't exist if the boundaries have positive tension, but does exist if the boundaries have negative tension. So if all I do is add in very simplistically something in my theory which with a negative tension boundary, there's nothing preventing these instantons from forming and eating my space-time. Because they're kind of associated with negative energy in a way, these can have exponentially enhanced tunneling rates, and your space-time can be strongly unstable to the formation of these holes. So there was something perturbatively stable that had a non-perturbative instability. Likewise, another example of something which is pretty well known that seems perturbatively stable is a ghost condensate, which is a higher derivative scalar field theory of a very specific form, which has an NEC violating vacuum. You can construct similar instantons, which are similar to the kind of classic Coleman-Delucia instantons between De Sitter space, where in the Coleman-Delucia case, you have a bubble wall that separates two De Sitter regions, and the tension of the bubble wall is positive. And you also typically have an exponentially suppressed tunneling rate. However, if you allow for field theories with NEC violating minima, then we've constructed instantons which have negative tension bubble walls. This means that you might have exponentially enhanced tunneling between vacua in theories of this type. Even though they're perturbatively stable, once you add in these non-perturbative effects, the vacuum becomes very different than you thought. And you can construct explicit examples of these. They're perfectly good instantons. They have negative modes. They have well-defined Euclidean tunneling rates. And what they represent are non-perturbative instabilities that were lurking inside these NEC violators. So maybe that there's more examples like this which can be found. Another possibility is that maybe something like a negative tension boundary or orientable plane is completely fine. Maybe these instabilities don't exist at all, and there's really nothing wrong with it. So then there's still questions that you can ask in the inflationary case. One of the questions has to do with the transition between an inflating epoch and a reheating epoch, where I know I have an accelerating universe that has to then decelerate after inflation. So let me give you an example of the kind of thing you can ask. So suppose I have an inflating universe. The theorems say that this average between the energy density and the extra dimensional pressure has to be negative. Now, this is maybe not so surprising. Typically, in these constructions, I have something like a negative tension boundary. It's located in a region where the warp factor is large. So this negative tension boundary is going to dominate an average which is weighted by the warp factor, as this one is. So this seems completely natural in that setup. Now, as I transition to radiation domination, the theorems say that this average now goes positive. It's harder to understand what's going on here, because here I argued that this is natural because I have this large source of negative tension, which is located in a region with large warp factor, and so it dominates this average. So what happens over here? Well, there has to be some kind of adjustment at the end of inflation. There has to be some form of energy density which appears in the bulk, some strong perturbation to the curvature in the bulk, or something else that's happening. Or maybe the source of NEC violation during inflation is some additional physics that was going on in the bulk that's now absent. So in this case, even if we can construct, let's say, a completely consistent accelerating vacuum, there might be difficulties in transitioning out of that accelerating epoch and into a decelerating epoch. In some simple examples, like in one dimension, you can show that you do need additional sources of NEC violation beyond just these negative tension objects. So that's all I'm going to have to say about inflation. And I want to switch gears a little bit in the last few minutes. And these have kind of been kind of big picture questions. And now,
radiation in the bulk?
That's a good question. But it turns out that radiation exerts pressure along our large dimensions, but it never along the compact dimensions that you have. In other words, P3 for radiation is 1/3 rho, but pK is always zero.
Why?
That's it's what you get when you do the calculation. But one
photons are not moving.
Why not? They can move in a extra dimension. I mean, they're energetic enough. They can. Depends on how you.
Well, the moments are all along the non-compact dimensions. Mm-hmm. Like if they're a massless particle in 4D, then their extra dimensional part of their wave function is just a zero mode. It's just.
But that's an assumption. I don't think that's the need to.
We want to explain the realistic universe.
But this is at the end of inflation. But this is at the end of inflation, not today.
No, it's in the radiation dominated wave function. That means.
Okay, you mean until
4D radiation.
Okay.
And 4D radiation doesn't mean.
That's true. You're right.
There's also a really fancy way of seeing it, which is that if I have radiation in 4D, it's conformally invariant. And I can do conformal transformations by changing the size of my extra dimensional space. I know that doesn't change the stress energy in 4D, so I can change in the extra dimensions. So radiation isn't enough. But okay, so. These are kind of some maybe big picture questions, maybe some things to look into. But I want to switch gears now and get a little bit more into data. And I'm also going to switch gears and go from the very early universe to the very late universe, so the present day. And what I want to talk about is what implications these arguments have for the problem of dark energy. So as I said, in the late 90s, it was discovered that the expansion rate of the universe was accelerating. One way to accommodate that is to introduce a new energy component with a very negative equation of state. As experiments have been getting better and better, the constraints on the equation of state of this new component have been getting ever closer to -1, the value you'd expect for a cosmological constant. And in fact, everything we know right now is completely consistent with a cosmological constant. There are lots of experiments people are going to be doing over the next few decades, which are going to promise to really tighten these error bounds. But the thing is, we could conclusively prove that this dark energy component were not a cosmological constant if we either measured that W were different than -1, or if we measured that W was changing with time. Either one of those, right off the bat, would rule out a cosmological constant. But another possibility is that these measurements just more and more accurately confirm that this is a cosmological constant. In that case, we're kind of faced with a problem. And there's kind of two problems that come up. One of the problems is that there are many models that can mimic a cosmological constant very closely. As a simple example, let's say I just have a slowly rolling scalar field with a potential, something like quintessence, that has weak couplings to other matter. If I compute the equation of state of this scalar field, I find it's -1 plus a correction that comes from the slope of the potential in this field. The bigger the slope, the faster the field's rolling, and the further the equation of state is from -1. Now, if I imagine the most ambitious mission that people are thinking about in order to constrain dark energy parameters, I'm talking about a 3 sigma, something like constraint W dark is less than about -0.96. So a few percent from the value you'd expect for a cosmological constant. In this model, I can arrange for that by just having my slope be something like 1/3 in natural units. So, you know, doesn't seem like a particularly fine-tuned value, but it's certainly within the parameter space I can choose for my model. And if experiments get better, I can just, you know, reduce this to 1/10 or 1/30 or something like that. This model, just by measuring W, can never be distinguished by a cosmological constant, regardless of how precise your experiment gets. So how do we know that it wasn't this model and instead of something else? Another problem is sort of the inverse problem. Like, suppose that for some reason we become absolutely convinced that it is a cosmological constant and nothing else. One logical possibility then is just to say, well, we live in a 4-dimensional universe. It has this extra constant of nature. We've just measured it. We're done. Or another possibility is that this is evidence that we live in a particular vacuum in some kind of string landscape with each of these vacua coming along with a very complicated construction. And maybe there's other parts of the universe we can't see with different vacua. It's also a logical possibility, but we can't distinguish between these two just by confirming that we've measured a cosmological constant.
So we could have spent all this money on these surveys and then basically be back where we are today, but with less money. So there's one way out of this. And this is work with Paul Steinhardt, which is really close to being finished. And basically what we've shown is that if you, as we make more precise measurements of the dark energy equation of state and combine them in a specific way with constraints on variation in Newton's constant, you can actually probe this kind of extra dimensional physics. What's interesting about it is that as dark energy surveys provide ever more stringent constraints on the dark energy parameters around lambda, you can start to progressively rule out families of extra dimensional models. And what's interesting about this is you keep learning things even if all of your measurements are consistent with the cosmological constant. So you don't need to see deviations from lambda to be able to conclude anything. You can continue to see them even as your error bars shrink around lambda. So the thing that's kind of surprising about this, I guess, is that how has variation of fundamental constants come in here? Well, it comes in because of these two fundamental equations that I introduced earlier. These are the ones that I used to derive the E-folding bounds. Now remember that zeta is describing how rapidly the extra dimensional volume is changing. Now the in models with extra dimensions, the four-dimensional Newton's constant, Gn4, is related to the one in the extra dimensional theory by a simple formula involving the total volume of my extra dimensional space. So if zeta is not zero and the volume is changing, then I have to have a change in my four-dimensional Newton's constant. And that change is directly related to zeta, and I can get a change both instantaneously and secular change in Newton's constant. To probe this, we approach this problem by basically parametrizing a model for the dark energy equation of state. We have no reason to think that any dark energy model would give a dependence on the scale factor that looks anything like this, but it's a useful way to just parameterize what you know about the value of the dark energy equation of state and how rapidly it's changing with time. Also, the Dark Energy Task Force, which has made projections for the precision of upcoming dark energy surveys, uses a linear parameterization just like this, so we can use their results to help us make our projections. We've added on a quadratic piece here, which is basically there for a few less interesting reasons, but we don't report any values for this parameter there. It's basically a nuisance parameter for us. So what can you find out in this case? Well, the first thing you can do is you can try to figure out what parts of the W0, WA parameter space are available to models which satisfy the conditions of the theorems, things that models which satisfy NEC and have extra dimensional metrics of a certain type. You find that there are some parts of parameter space which are excluded, but also a pretty hefty chunk which is included. So at every point in here, I can find a model where the four-dimensional equation of state has these values of the dark energy parameters, and I can solve those two fundamental equations from a few slides ago. So at each of these points, there's an associated dark energy evolution and a profile for variation of Gn over time. But in this plot, I haven't included data. So this is just things that are excluded theoretically. So if, for example, we constrain dark energy to be somewhere up here, we'd know right off the bat that this entire class of models is ruled out. So let's start putting some data in to see what we know. So one family of constraints comes from dark energy alone. And for this, we've used the Dark Energy Task Force constraint projections. They basically divide up what we can expect from experiment into four stages. One is pretty much what we know now. And we do know a little bit about WA, but on the scale of this plot, it's not very much. So I've just implemented that as a one sigma constraint on W0. Stage two programs are things which are ongoing, very near future experiments that are running. Stage three are proposed experiments in the near future. And stage four are very ambitious future experiments like a square kilometer array or a joint dark energy mission or something like that. The other kind of constraints we can throw in are constraints on variation in Newton's constant. For that, there are constraints on the secular variation of Newton's constant from BVN. It's kind of classic constraints. And also some constraints on, from radar ranging in the inner solar system and pulsar timing variations. And these are the numbers that we're using. interestingly enough, this number here tells you that G is varying by order one, less than 1/10 over the entire history of the universe. So this is a very slow, this is a very strong constraint on the variation of G. So what we do is, for each of those points, which represent a dark energy model, we see if we can solve those two equations and satisfy these constraints on G variation all at the same time. And that's going to cut down even more the allowed region of parameter space in our model. So this plot here is just kind of for fun. Because we know from ever since Gibbons and Navesian and Nunez that we have to violate strong energy condition if we have a de Sitter universe in four dimensions. So now you can ask, you can kind of turn that question around, I guess, in a little way. You can say, based on what we actually know about our universe, and how close it is to de Sitter, and how much the Newton's constant is varying, can we then turn around and say that the strong energy condition must be violated in my extra dimensional theory? It turns out you can't quite say that. We're just far enough from de Sitter, and the constraints on Newton's constant variation are just loose enough that you can sort of get away with it, but not very well. So a lot of this plot is excluded by more than three sigma. So these are places where I have models, but the combination of dark energy constraints and Newton's variation constraints are more than three sigma away from the experimentally preferred values. There's also a region where you agree to within three sigma, but the agreement isn't really that great. I think the best agreement is, you know, some fraction, 2.5. Sorry?
The allowed region.
Oh, sorry. So yeah, this, so here, so everything in this kind of football is allowed sort of theoretically without data. Everything out of here, I can't even solve those equations at all. So everything here, there's at least some solution for zeta and for the dark energy evolution. But inside here, these regions are excluded by the data. So the required rate of change of Newton's constant is too great to be accommodated by pulsar measurements. The current state of knowledge for a slightly different metric category is a little bit more interesting. It's already under pressure at roughly 2 sigma. And what this basically says is I can't construct a model which has this family of metrics and satisfies the null energy condition and gives me a variation of Newton's constant and dark energy parameters consistent with observation. I don't actually have any explicit examples of that model to hand, but I know that you can't make one because that's what these results are saying. And as you can see, it's already under a lot of pressure at about 2 sigma. So I can ask the question, what else would I have to do to completely knock out this category of extra-dimensional dark energy models? One thing I could do is I could say, OK, maybe I just need better dark energy constraints. If you do it that way, it turns out the least ambitious thing you have to do is go to a DETF stage 4 measurement. And that measurement has to go really well. The least optimistic projection that gives you a strong enough dark energy constraint to completely rule out this model is a stage 4, something like an advanced satellite mission that goes really well. The O is for optimistic. And here you've ruled out this category of extra dimensional models to just over 3 sigma.
Because you have more space there? If you present k equal 2, or you really
know? Well, I don't know what k equals 2 looks like. Yeah, we just looked at 6 because, you know, it's the string theory choice. Okay. So, but I don't know.
There are some models in k equal 2.
I haven't looked at them, but I could make a plot. No, it's the same.
And your model is, since k equal 2 would be even harder.
My intuition is that it would be, hard to say. I don't actually know which way it would go off the top of my head. It's with this particular category of metrics, the CRF1, the sort of threshold equations of state tend to be a function which strongly depends on how many dimensions you have. And so it's not exactly monotonically going down or going up. But yeah, if there are interesting models in that class, it's easy enough to make a constraint plot for that as well.
Because your previous plots were going down, and then it was modeled again.
Yeah, that's here. I'm trying to get more information across, so I really have to just pick one k, because of the way it depends on these additional dark energy.
So in these models, most of the evolution in G, does it happen at the early times or at late times?
So it's happening at late times. It's responding to the transition to acceleration in four dimensions. The closer w gets to -1, the more these extra dimensions have to evolve in order to satisfy NEC.
That's relying a lot on, if you're assuming that the four-dimensional energy G is related to the symbology of fixed radiation.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The 92 kind of plasma company can line up the true type of one.
So if you have models where you change the graviton kinetic terms, then you lose that relationship. So something like a DGP model wouldn't have the same relationship. But if you stick to Kaluza Klein, this, for example, like in Randall syndrome, there's a strange relationship between. But this actually computes it correctly because it uses the warped volume of the extra dimensional space instead of the.
I'm more talking at correction
factor, EGP, which is, you have gas coming to everything, that those would fit into that higher derivative category in the few slides ago. Well, that's an interesting question that I haven't looked into. But it's to the extent you can put the additional terms on the right hand side, they have to look like something that's effectively Anderson violating. But in this case, so I've just said that if all I do is increase my dark energy precision, I have to do something very ambitious to rule out this category of models. It turns out a better strategy is actually to just improve my dark energy measurements a little bit, but tighten my constraints on G variation. So here's something where I just have a dark energy measurement that's stage two. So that's something, you know, near future. But what I've done is asked for a mild improvement on my constraints on instantaneous Newton's constant variation. So maybe pulsar constraints get a little bit better by a factor of two. In this case, you actually get a stronger discriminating power for this class of models. Here, by just improving dark energy constraints, I've ruled out 3.5 sigma. Here, by doing a mild improvement in both dark energy and Newton's constant variation, I've ruled out to about the same level of significance. But this is a case where now I can't say that models of this type are ruled out, models in this broad family. But I could say that they are if I were able to combine slightly improved constraints from dark energy along with slightly improved constraints from Newton's constant variation. Okay.
So what are you assuming is the true value of the end of these years?
Okay, so I'm assuming here that experimentally we always find things where the central value is right on the cosmological constant.
Why are the ellipses looking?
Why are they at this? Well, so they're tilted like this because dark energy surveys typically don't constrain W most strongly at the present day. They typically constrain it most strongly at some redshift like 0.3 or 0.4. And at that redshift, the equation of state is a linear combination of W not WA. So that rotates it like this. The other thing that's funny is that the minimum is not here, even though this is what I'm assuming for my fiducial dark energy model. That's happening because if it were right there, satisfying NEC forces Newton's constant to be varying extremely rapidly. And so there's a huge conflict with experiments. By coming up here, the models are putting a little bit more pressure on their dark energy constraints, but they're also allowing Newton's constant vary less quickly. And this is basically the sweet spot for where you can have just enough Newton's constant so you don't conflict too much, but also not too far away from the lambda CD point for there. OK, so that's all I have to say about dark energy, since I guess we're pretty much at time for my conclusions. But I guess what excites me about this is that this not only raises some interesting questions about models that we maybe thought we understood really well, but it also provides some techniques to really leverage future dark energy surveys to tell us something about extra-dimensional physics. So, thank you.
Any questions? So if your G is changing, then you probably should reevaluate all these dark energy constraints because they're all assumed constants.
Yeah. And here we've taken those constraints to be constraints on the Einstein Gram-Scale factor. But
so all these surveys would have probably their own sensitivity to G variation as well as dark.
Yeah, I think if it were I wonder how much of an effect that would be. I don't know precisely, but one thing that might make it seem small is that. So the pulsar constraints don't be chopped
in the box.
In the other box.
So if I say that the natural scale for G variation is something like the age of the universe, then that would give me a G dot over G for about 10 to the minus 11 per year. Well, 10 to the minus 10 per year, I suppose, because the universe is about 10 to the 10 years old. And this is also the rate G would have to be varying to create a large difference between the Jordan frame and the Einstein frame scale factor. But from pulsars, G variation is already constrained at the 10 to the minus 12 level. So what this is saying is, maybe because this is about 1% of that, is that the difference between Einstein and Jordan frame scale factor is going to be like a 1% sort of effect. So for us, it's easier just to use the Einstein frame one, since there's never any ambiguity about what you're talking about there.
But of course, all these hybrids are after 1% effects, right? The XW constraints.
Yeah, so maybe, you know, maybe you could detect something like that. like one thing we haven't looked at are, for example, how this would affect relative perturbations or things like that, which is going to be really important for future surveys. And because we're concentrating on background solutions, that's not really as important for us. But you know, when they, we're basically just using their constraints on how W dark is evolving with time.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about these orthogonal planes. Orientable planes, which people use. I mean, they're negative tangential planes.
That's right, yeah.
And the worrying thing about them is that they're right in the middle of the bulk, too. They're not boundary of these extra dimensions.
Yeah.
I actually haven't had a clear explanation from anyone how they even.
How they
work. I mean, they can be described just using GR.
So they're definitely tricky stuff, and I'm not an expert in orientables, but in the simplest ansatz that people use for these flux compactifications will break down usually some distance away from the orientable planes. Some important metric component goes negative, for example, or the warp factor, the omega will go negative as you approach these orientable planes. It's possible that it would be difficult to work near them while staying in the context of GR.
But that's in some approximation to the Fourier algebra. That's like an approximation to our KRH chain using some top-notch metric with narrative coefficient. That's why you got it becoming narrative.
I see. So you say there is a better description.
There should be a better match where you probably can study it.
Yeah, like the simplest, like GKP ansatz.
Yeah.
Use that, and they go negative somewhere near the orientable plane. But I don't know what the better metric would be.
Yeah, so that metric is kind of approximation.
Is the barometric known, or you use three
days for your quite, I don't know if it's known for general cases, but. For some of the plane, it should be now. And what's okay? So one big difference is with this approximate metric, there's kind of an isometry circle. But in the exact metric, you don't see that. There's a U1 isometry in the approximate metric, which is just like what you have in Telnet, but. In our KRH chain, you actually don't expect to see that. There's the UI symmetry should be gone. But yeah, I'm not sure I can how big that will solve the, you know, if we took that into account, that will solve this problem of that. Yeah, I'm not sure like how these changes the things.
The thing that really confuses me about them is probably because I think about it too naively, but they're sort of fixed on the boundary. But in GR, I think if I like wiggle space-time, they have to wiggle too somehow. But it seems like they're not allowed to, and that's something I've never really understood about how they fit into the picture. It seems like there must be a pretty heavy restriction on the allowed fluctuation modes that I can have in bulk. But maybe that's not the right way to think about it. I don't know.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is the metric isn't topological. Just in a more naive sense, but whether it has something to do with inside.
And this question of the bubble nucleation, have you thought about it in a more realistic context?
So the big difference about these bubbles and a real orientable plane would be the fact that real orientables carry charges. Mm-hmm. And we've just looked at neutral boundaries because it's just the simplest thing to look at.
That charge might be cancelled by other places in the
It should be. I mean, there's discrete, a couple of discrete constraints in flux compactifications where you ensure that all charge has to vanish. But for the pair production question, it means that just having one boundary that nucleates is too simplistic for charged objects because you use conservation of charge. On the other hand, electrons and positrons have charges, but we know they can pair produce as well. So maybe there's a more complicated solution which would be consistent with charge conservation, but I haven't looked into it too much.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Can I ask? So if I think about quantum gravity, so our universe, we think that the Einstein action is a great action, describes a lot of physics. But we think that it's really only an effective low energy action, and there are going to be terms that are higher curvature terms or all sorts of interesting terms. Mm. And generically, those are going to, violate all of the energy conditions. So do you want to comment on that?
Well, here's what I would worry about. I mean, I don't know for sure that can't work. But, if they are violating all the energy conditions, the interesting question to me would be, how does one avoid pathological solutions, which happen when we know the energy conditions are violated? How would I protect myself from being able to write down solutions which violate causality or allow superluminal travel?
Say then that it should be a constraint on quantum gravity that these terms don't exist or that they're arranged in a way?
So one possibility is that these terms exist and then we just have to accept the fact that these things we thought were pathological really aren't, because somehow they make sense in the right way. But the other possibility is that these terms exist and then there's some principle that we don't quite understand that prevents you from constructing like traversable wormholes or close time-like curves, and that's, in that way they would exist and be completely consistent with everything we know now. But it's hard for me to think of what that constraint would be, like where things would go wrong when I tried to use these terms to construct a solution that I previously thought was pathological.
But wouldn't it, well, let's talk more over that.
Okay.
I mean, there are examples, for example, where those corrections would come in the form of would qualitatively change the CFT, describing the string theory. Right? And there are simple examples where a CFT is constructed, which involves all of these terms intrinsically.
Right.
And so that might lie behind the stabilization of the explanation. But it's... And that's what you're thinking.
No, I'm thinking much more simply. But it's a lunchtime conversation.
But I have a comment on that, because you can construct solutions even in GR that are not that violate causality.
Yeah.
It's just that those solutions are not physical solutions.
And you just exclude them. Yeah.
Why wouldn't it be the same here?
Well, you might be able to start from somewhere that makes sense, like start from a solution describing us in the room. And then if you allow these terms, maybe I can start from the sensible solution and then do something and then construct something bad. And then it's harder to exclude that.
If they're unavoidable, then I guess.
Yeah.
Well, can you get to as far as I know, all the things which we know how to, without violating energy conditions, you had to put it in by hand to start with.
Sure.
You can't go from an end of road being black hole to an over road being black hole.
Okay.